How's it going, everybody? My name is Greg Knox. These are the worst date movies ever. If you've not done so already, please like, share, subscribe, and all that usual stuff. As you'll know, if you've clicked on this episode, we're going to be reviewing a Serbian film today. It's a Serbian film. You know what you're getting yourself into. It's really fucking disturbing. Yeah, we all know. And as always, lots of spoilers, yada, yada, yada. We know the drill. But that's not the biggest reason that I'm excited today, because I'm actually not by myself on this episode, because I'm joined on the show today by a very special guest. He's one of the first film reviewers I subscribed to on YouTube. He's been making videos for over 12 years, and he's still producing incredible content to this day. He's one of the OGs of the disturbing movie review scene, if you want to call it that. This channel, and many others, wouldn't exist without him. Put some respect on this man's name. He is the one, the only, Lampy Man 101 himself, Mr. Glenn Criddle. How's it going, my man?
Thank you very much for that exuberant welcome. It's going, it's going fine. Thank you for inviting me.
That's all right. So when I put it to you that you've been making videos since 2009... I mean, does it really feel like it's been that long?
Sometimes, yes. it's one of those weird things. When you first start doing this kind of stuff, I think I was producing something like 4 or 5 videos a week at one point. So for the first few months I was doing it. And it's like the time flies, goes really, really fast. And because I do this as a hobby, more than anything, this is not not an entirely professional thing, though I have done some professional work. It's all kind of slotted in with the rest of my life. So the pacing tends to depend on kind of everything else that's going on around me.
Wow. Okay. That's cool. So going back to kind of the very, very start, sort of pre-YouTube, when did you first get into horror films, and what was the first horror film that you remember watching?
I'd always had a kind of marginal interest in it up until sort of like from about the early 80s, when I was like, you know, getting to around 10 years old and you start becoming aware of these things. Other than films, you know, that kids' films that could legitimately be described as horror films. The first film that I do remember watching that was explicitly a horror was in about 1982, I think it was, and it was Alien, funny enough.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I remember seeing in the newspaper that like a local TV channel, not ours, but a neighboring one, had it on, and it wasn't in our area. So somehow we managed to just tune our television in just enough to catch the film. And it was in black and white and grainy and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, it actually made the experience even more terrifying.
I was going to say, it probably did, yeah.
So that was my first taste of that. And it sort of built up over the years. And, of course, being the early 80s, all the stuff was bubbling over about the video nasties and that kind of stuff. You'd see it in the newspapers, and you'd walk past these little ad hoc kind of stores. I do remember one being in a converted front living room a corner, right? That's how small they were back in the day. They were just little private interests, none of this Blockbusters type stuff or anything like that. And I remember walking past that place every day to go to school and seeing the poster for Driller Killer.
Oh, okay.
Right up in the window, and always sort of furtively glancing over at it and kind of wondering what the hell that was all about. Being
not surprised.
You're kind of intrigued, but also sort of repelled by this imagery. And it was really sort of a few years later that I kind of started picking up on that, you know, particularly kind of post video nasties scare, finding these movies. And then sort of eventually kind of learning what the issues were behind them and how difficult it was to get hold of the original versions and seeing how cut they were.
All right. Which actually, I was sort of too young to kind of remember the video nasties for it itself kind of in the early 80s, because I was born in 1983. So I missed out on all that, but I had an interest in banned films, like, because I remember the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and The Exorcist being banned and A Clockwork Orange being banned and stuff like that. So was part of the appeal of the video nasties to you that was it like a clandestine thing, like because they're banned and that kind of made them more appealing, or was it not that?
I think for me it was more like kind of it wasn't explicitly because they were banned, but there was always that kind of enticing sort of idea of what it was you weren't allowed to see.
Right.
One of the first video, well, actually Section 3 was one of the first ones that I actually got to see, which was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I picked that up secondhand off of a friend when I was studying at this sort of regional college type thing. And he sold it to me for £15, I think it was. So I've got an original copy of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Uncut on my shelf behind me.
Awesome.
And eventually, my sister's boyfriend came over to our place for an evening, and he bought these two films. And I didn't know there were video nasties at the time, but it was Cannibal Apocalypse and I Spit on Your Grave.
Ooh.
So we had a double bill of that, which was quite... which is quite something.
I can only imagine.
Yes. But, yeah, I particularly that was one of the things that really kind of sparked my interest in these things. I mean, it took me a while to appreciate them for what they were. But by the mid to late 90s, I was really kind of getting a real interest in those films that were caught up in that stuff, and I'd become aware much more of the political situation than I was at the time. Because I was just old enough to be in that target demographic of, we've got to look out for these children kind of thing, you know, which was going on during the 80s.
Daily Mail hasn't changed. For those people who don't live in the UK, they've always been a shit newspaper, but yeah, they're just, I don't know if they're more shit or less shit or equally as shit now, but let's just say they're a shit newspaper. Leave it at that.
They're quite something. Yeah. They are quite something. Although, funnily enough, a lot of people don't seem to realise that the Daily Express was the one that kicked it all off, which is kind of, yeah. The Mail sort of came along about a year later after the Express started doing this stuff and then really started rattling the sabre because they were so Tory aligned. And at that point, the Tories were being dragged into it. One way or another, and then Graham Bright jumped on board and then started pushing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Express was just as bad. I mean, I've got a big folder of the scans of the newspaper articles that happened around the time. So literally, it's about 2 inches thick, this thing.
Wow. Awesome. We're talking about video nasties. I mean, what was it that inspired you to want to start a YouTube channel? Because this is the very early days of YouTube, wasn't it? So, yeah, what made you want to create videos at the time?
sad story is I was in a job. I was really depressed. I was annoyed. I just split up with a girl. And quite frankly, I could just feel my brain dying off at that time. So I wanted some way of just sort of getting myself back into thinking. Literally, that's that, you know, so I wasn't just waking up in the morning, going to work, being depressed, coming back home, being depressed, eat dinner, be depressed, go to sleep. So essentially, it sort of got born out of that, me just wanting something to focus on, really. That was the drive for it initially. And I kind of just zeroed in on my love of writing about films. I'd been doing that at university previous to that.
Okay.
And I kind of went, okay, so can I apply my film studies thing?
Oh, okay. So you did film studies at university then?
It was one of the courses I did, yeah. I did, I studied in York. And one of my modules, I did it for 2 years running, was film studies. That's what I did my dissertation and stuff in. In fact, I did two dissertations on it.
Okay.
Which is a little unusual. Oh God! I took the subject of the video nasties and I kind of went into that. And originally it was going to be one dissertation, and I rapidly found out that, you know, as I started kind of formulating this thing, that it was not going to be very easy to fit into 9,000 words.
Right.
You know, so you sort of go, right, okay, what am I going to do about this? But as it was, I was supposed to be doing another module which happened to fall through. So I went to my lecturer and I says, look, what can I do about this? He goes, well, you can do an independent study unit. I was like, okay, so what's that? He goes, well, you can pretty much do whatever you want. I says, can I do a second dissertation? He goes, yeah.
Oh, wow.
He says, can I take my dissertation I'm doing now, split it down the middle and take it in two different directions? He goes, yeah. So essentially my dissertation study or research and all that kind of stuff was all pushing in the same direction, just splitting it in the writing. So I did all that kind of stuff. And I think one half was about the politics and one half was about the films, that kind of stuff, you know, what the cuts and edits, the differences that kind of made to the films, that sort of thing. So I kind of hearkened back to this when I was just going, I just need some sort of creative outlet, you know, some sort of way of something to focus on. And I started, I came up with doing the Nasties review.
Okay. That's cool.
There wasn't really much of that around at the time.
Yeah.
So my option was really like, can I do that? I kind of went, yeah, fine. At which point, you know, I got about three episodes in and I started going, oh shit, how the hell am I supposed to get hold of half of these films?
Yeah, that was interesting, yeah.
And that was difficult. That was difficult to start with. I mean, yes, I could get probably about 70% of them relatively easy. Bear in mind, when I started this, Amazon wasn't such a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there wasn't easy. It wasn't easy to find these things. Nowadays, it's so easy. You can just, go to like kind of Cannibal Holocaust DVD and you'll get multiple options from multiple countries.
Yeah.
And my film lecturer actually got me a bootleg of Cannibal Holocaust for one thing.
Cool.
He also was the one that advised me to go watch Salo with a smirk on his face.
Wow.
Yeah.
Someone I know is a friend of a friend who actually has three different copies of Cannibal Holocaust in his DVD collection. They're not the same. They're like three totally different versions. And there's a reason why he's got three versions. But I always treated that as a huge thing that I had respect for, that he had that many different versions of that film.
I can't remember if I've got two or three myself.
Wow.
I've got a couple at least. It's like Salo, I've got a couple of copies of. Eraserhead, which not a video nasty, obviously, I've got about four different versions of. Same with Dune, I've got about four or five.
Wow.
Sometimes it's just like, you pick up the best that's at the time, then a better one comes along. But getting those.
You don't want to get rid of the old one.
No, because sometimes they have stuff on them that the other versions don't have. It's like the at least two versions of Cannibal Holocaust I got the, I think it's EC version. Which is one of the earlier ones. Then we've got Grindhouse releasing edition
the
as well.
The Grindhouse one is the main one because that's got all the extras on it, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It has. It has. So, you know, I mean, when it comes down to it, that's one of the things with physical media and stuff like that. It's so important because you've got all those various bits and pieces that are on there, and those in themselves are collectible. So there's, you get quite an archive after a while rather than just getting presented like with Prime, you just get this thing dumped at you.
There's something about owning physical media as well that I like. So I like owning things as well. It's something sort of tangible that you can actually hold in your hands and it's yours and they can't edit it as well, which is something, you know, censorship, which is obviously something that you're quite passionate about. And that I actually wanted to talk about sort of a bit later on in the interview as well. I know you mentioned, like, so you made videos. Did you watch any other channels? Were there even any other channels doing this kind of content? Because I remember when I kind of first discovered you, there was a guy called Dark Angel 182 who'd made, like, videos along the lines of, here's my DVD collections. And, yeah, he did, like, my Video Nasties collection. And because YouTube didn't allow you to have videos over 10 minutes at that point, it was, like, seven different videos. So that was, I think, the first Video Nasties videos I saw, and then the algorithm pointed me in your direction kind of when you started.
Back in the day when it would do that.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Did I watch any channels? Yes, there was a few knocking around. Most of them have gone away since, you know, people have walked away from YouTube eventually. They just sort of petered out and went away. Dark Angel was one of them. In fact, Dark Angel was a resource of mine quite early on, before YouTube days, for finding out about that kind of stuff. So Simon is a lovely guy. I've had him on my channel on a couple of occasions. Mostly when we're doing like Alien or something Alien related, because he's nuts about that series.
Awesome.
It's Live Fast Diarrhea, who's a German guy.
I remember that name. Yeah, he used to post comments on your videos a lot.
Yeah, he was lovely as well. And that was the thing, you know, it's a very small community, but very, very friendly. And, you know, I'm kind of lucky. I don't have exactly a huge subscriber base. I'm not going to say it's teeny tiny, because it's doing all right, but it's by YouTube standards, I am kind of like a grain of sand on the beach, which is fine, because the community is much more close and friendly. The when I do like a live stream, the chat's a lot kind of calmer, which is quite nice. So it's a good thing, but it's kind of strange as well, because now I'm sort of more in the situation that with the people I used to like. You know, I'd talk to someone like Simon, and it's like, kind of, oh, I've been watching your videos for years, man. It's like, kind of, now people come to me and they're like, which is very gratifying, you know, especially when someone sort of turns around and goes, oh yeah, you know, you kind of inspired me to do this, that, or the other. It's one of the more rewarding things that you can get from doing this. My channel is not monetized or anything like that. I did have it monetized to it. I had some kind of monetization for a while, but then I kind of got rid of it because I didn't need the pressure. I didn't want to go down that line of making it a job.
Exactly.
That can be quite difficult. It puts pressure on you that you don't particularly need. You know, I've got to generate content, and sometimes you can't force that stuff.
100% agree. Are there any, incidentally, like, I know you mentioned sort of, we're talking about channels from like when you started. Are there any sort of channels that cover this kind of content that have been around maybe in the last few years that you follow or subscribe? And do you have kind of any opinions on them if you've seen any of their videos? Not trying to name names or throw any shade at anyone, like, if you don't want to.
There are some very, very good channels. So BRB 30,000, who I'm friendly with, he doesn't do an awful lot these days, but he has done some really magnificent reviews. And you do get those occasional channels that come along that you sort of look at, you go, that's serious competition. You've got to take it in the right way. You've got to, when you look at that sort of stuff and somebody covers the same stuff that you do, which you're obviously going to do with something like the Video Nasties. My channel was generally dedicated to stuff which is a niche subject. So there's limited kind of resources that I can look at, and get, I'm certainly not going to be one of those people who goes, you can't use my that film, because I've done that film, you know. It's like, why would you be like that?
Has that happened to you at all, by the way?
I've had one or two occasions where somebody's lifted stuff from mine. I've had literally a channel re-uploading my stuff on one occasion.
Just that's when you know you've made it.
Downloaded it, and it's like, kind of, I sort of sent him a message that says, you know, kind of, come on, that's not. And I think there was about 40,000 views on one of the videos. And I go, that's 40,000 views you're taking away from me. But then, you know, I kind of voiced my displeasure about I wasn't going to go down the line of, you know, copyright striking it and that kind of stuff, although I'd have been justified in doing so. But I know how it feels when I get done like that. Although, you know, arguably with the copyright stuff that I get is kind of distinctly unfair, really. For one thing, I did a review of Human Centipede 2, and it was a pretty positive review for the most part. I think I said something along the lines of, it's clearly doing something interesting, at least to begin with, but then it sort of peters out because it's just a very thin premise taken a very long way. Mm. And Ilona Six, the sister of the director, Tom Six, struck my video down.
Oh, no.
I was like, really? Really? It's like literally one of the only reviews on online at the time that kind of give the film a fair shot and you've just taken it down. Are you fucking mental?
And question.
Well, you know, yeah, I was more polite than that, obviously, but it was one of those things. You get all that kind of stuff, but there's at least one or two channels who have lifted, you know, my opinions in some respects and pretty much given them out for beta more, or the likes, but I kind of a little bit sort of, I try to let a lot of that stuff go. The YouTube community is really something that is, it's a bunch of amateurs. It's like myself.
Yeah.
And people make those mistakes. And as long as they're not arseholes about it, I tend not to get stressed about that kind of thing.
No, that's cool. That's cool. I have to ask, because this is going to seem like an obvious question for people who don't necessarily know you, who might be listening to this. What does Lampy Man 101
mean? The infamous early days of YouTube names. it was... I chose the name before I really had any idea what I was going to do with the channel, because I've been signed up for YouTube since about 2007-ish, 2006-2007. Mm. And it's always at that point where you're sort of having to fill out the forms and all that kind of stuff. And it goes, what would you like your username to be? I don't know, it's like SexGod99. I got no idea. And you sort of go, right, okay. And I just went LampyMan101. LampyMan really is, it's a reference to my real life work and my day job, which is as a theatre technician, as in the stage. I'm largely kind of biased towards lighting. So I went Lampy Man. The 101 was because you had to have numbers in there.
Right.
And I just went, well, room 101, okay. and that's what I've lived with. You can change it these days, but people know me as this now. You know, it's been a long time. That I've been known as that. So if I changed it, it'd just be weird. Occasionally go by the whole kind of cynical celluloid, kind of a pseudonym, which is kind of more a brand name.
What you would call the channel if you were sort of to, you know, start it a bit later when you didn't have to call yourself Lampy Man 101. So Lampy Man 101 would be you, like your online alias, like Neo. Matrix, and Cynical Celluloid would be what your whole channel would be called, I take it.
Yeah. I mean, I generally ascribe my work to Cynical Celluloid, if you know what I mean, but just because I like the alliteration and it kind of works with the sort of stuff that I review.
Ah, that's cool. And the name is just a name, it's fine. Like the name of my channel is just, it's just a name. It's just something I came up with randomly years ago. And I've just basically like, oh, that's quite funny. Like, I don't know, it amuses me. So how do you feel about your earliest videos? So I was going to say, like, the first video of yours I remember watching was either Cannibal Holocaust, which is quite a famous kind of video that you did near the start of your channel, or the What is Mondo? Mm-hmm. How do you feel about those early videos? Have you watched them? Do you cringe thinking about them, or how do you feel about it?
I don't cringe. Actually, there is a bit of a drive amongst some YouTubers to go around and revamp all their old stuff. And I've always had a little bit of a aversion to do that, a lot of an aversion to doing that. Quite apart from, I don't really see the need. I mean, because I stand by the content in those videos for the most part. You can definitely tell there's a shift in quality of various aspects of the videos. My videos became a bit longer, but that was partly down to the YouTube kind of limits and that kind of stuff.
I was going to say.
But how in depth I went with them and that kind of stuff has sort of expanded and, you know, kind of like, certainly because as I went along the series, I had a lot more experience of not only writing, but kind of being able to reference those films. So when I started, there wasn't so much of that. The biggest thing is the production values, obviously.
Yeah, just, kind of goes without saying. Yeah.
You know, my audio was shit. My video was basic. I started off with Windows Movie Maker, for God's sake. You know, it's which I very, very quickly started realizing the limits of, you know, within about half a dozen episodes. And I'm going, right, okay, I need to be able to cut this thing to within a couple of frames, and it gives you like a 5 or 6 frame kind of jump between where you can actually cut and things like that. So my you can see the shift in technology as you go along, you know, and my experience of using it, all that kind of stuff. But I kind of like that, because not only is it it's almost like a kind of biography for me, if you like, for doing what I do. So I kind of enjoy the fact that you can see where I came from and where I went to. I think that's quite a satisfying thing, rather than being one of these that, oh my God, now I've got to make it HD. You know, why? But yeah, I'll revisit stuff, if I feel that I've got something new to say about it, but, I won't revisit it just for the sake of kind of like tarting it up and stuff like that, because I think it's kind of a nice thing for new YouTubers or potential YouTubers, creators, to actually kind of see that I haven't always been like kind of where I am at the moment.
Mm.
You know, that I did come from very humble beginnings with absolutely, well, you're near shag all kind of technology behind me.
Yeah. Back then, it wasn't really a problem. Like, I never, when I was watching your early videos, or indeed any kind of videos that I was watching back in like 2009 or 2010, mm-hmm. like, I didn't think like audio quality's not great. Whatever. It's not something you really think about back then, because bear in mind kind of how people would have been watching these videos as well. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, yeah. I did get complaints about the audio and stuff like that. And eventually, you know, I sort of, you know, I kind of went, it isn't just people whinging, it does need kind of upgrading, that kind of stuff. But yeah. Like I say, I don't ever want to feel ashamed of that old work just because it isn't up to the current standards. It is what it is, and I like the fact that you can see the sort of progression in my work as you go along, even including where I've made mistakes. I think I've only ever taken down one video because I made such a glaring mistake in it that it was right. it was just I couldn't live with it, and that was one that Josh Hadley managed to pick up with a couple of others.
Am I allowed to ask which video that is, or is it deepest darkest secret?
No, it was I can't remember which one it was off the top of my head. I basically said the director's name completely wrong.
All right.
And it was like, so because he was a famous, really famous sort of producer director as well, that I just kind of went, yeah, I've got to take it down. So it's just, I'd only got like about 120 odd views on it or something like that at that time. But for me, that was like kind of, do I lose all these views? You know, because it felt like a lot at the time. But then I just kind of went, yeah, I can't live with that. So I had to take it down and just adjust it. That was just a kind of typo that slipped into my script. And I just kept saying this thing over and over again, right. And it was just like kind of, oh man, this is so wrong. This is so wrong. But other than the 2001 video that I did, I did a mini series of the last 10 minute films, which explain the endings to films like Taxi Driver, films like that, which have ambiguous endings. And the 2001, I had to. It's the only one I've ever had to disable comments on.
Really?
Yeah, because Kubrick fans can be weird.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's one word of warning I would give to anybody who's reviewing films is if you do a Kubrick review or analysis or anything like that, turn the fucking comments off, because you are going to your life is going to be hell. I was getting like about 20 odd comments on that a day. And it's still one of my biggest viewed videos. It's kind of right up there in about the top 10. And it's like, just the utter insanity of it. And because it's coming through to my phone, my inbox of my emails getting filled up. And I just went, enough's enough, because it's always the same sort of thing. It's a really batshit crazy conspiracy theory kind of Illuminati kind of thing. And I just went, I don't
can't have this. That.
And I got a couple of complaints about it. Why don't you allow people to discuss this? Because every day I'm getting this kind of like a batshit crazy kind of Kubrickite fan base just being unpleasant. Not that I couldn't handle the unpleasantness, it was just the volume of it. It was, it was just too much. I just went, no, it's making YouTube an unhappy place. So I just shut the comments off on that one.
Fair enough.
But yeah.
I mean, in fairness, Kubrick hasn't made any bad date movies, so I think I'll be all right. But I'll definitely take your feedback on board there. Yeah. So note to everyone, don't make any Kubrick videos. So that's your second most popular video in terms of kind of views. The most popular video you did is a Jungle Holocaust review that you did, which has got over 2 million views, which I think is absolutely mental. What I was going to ask is, are there any kind of videos you made which have, let's say, a lot of views that you were surprised that they were viewed by so many people? Like the algorithm picked it up and it just went supernova?
I think mostly it's a bit of a surprise that for whatever reason, at least for a few years it happened, any video I made with the word cannibal in kind of just went crazy. You know, they'd got good views. I think the most surprising thing for me was, though, that the couple of the videos that I was most proud of, which was like the summer season review ones, those didn't get much at all. They just didn't get any traction. And I think it's much to do with the fact that I'm kind of, my audience is kind of specialist. And I went into...
I know the feeling, it's fine.
Yeah. Sometimes when you stray outside your wheelhouse, then you just don't get much interest in them. Which was a shame, really, because, I mean, Holy Motors one in particular, I was so proud of that. And it's still, you know, kind of under 1,000 views, I think it is. You kind of go, yeah, that's a shame, really, because a lot of effort went into it. But there you go. Yeah, I mean, you have to take the rough with the smooth sometimes. And it doesn't deter me if I kind of like go, right, okay, I want to do something which is a bit outside my wheelhouse. I'll do it anyway. I'm not reliant on the income from it. So I will do what I want to do. And most of my kind of more hardcore fans are still interested to hear in that stuff, hear about that stuff anyway. So I kind of go, why not? I do have a certain amount of freedom because I've got no reliance on it. And I'm kind of glad I went down that line just because YouTube is a bit of a shit show when it comes to making a living on.
Yeah. I was going to say, I wonder, this wasn't actually a question that I wrote down, but it's something that I thought about for a little while. And you've probably had a similar experience to me in this sense, because my previous channel that I was doing was just horror. And that was kind of limiting to me in a certain extent, because I like a lot of films that are not just horror. Like, if I want to talk about, let's say, Come and See, for example, which is a film that I absolutely love, I want to be able to do that. So hence why I created this channel, and I kind of did it in such a way where I don't have to restrict myself to just horror films. But do you find that there are horror fans, and I stress, I've said this before, so hashtag not all horror fans. So not all horror fans are like this, but there are a lot of horror fans. It's not just a minority, unfortunately, where they seem to only like horror films like based on very kind of limited criteria, sort of how scary is it, how gory is it. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that per se, but if you try and do anything kind of slightly outside of that wheelhouse, then it doesn't quite get the reaction that maybe it should do. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, if that's always the thing. I mean, when it comes to like channel growth and things like that, a lot of people sort of go, you know, some of my fans go, oh, you should have so many more subscribers. I go, well, biggest problem with my channel is that it is generally so niche. It is kind of focused at a very kind of narrow part of the market. And let's face it, you know, for all the love that we have for the genre, it is and always will be a fringe of cinema. What I try to do with my channel, though, is try to offer up, you know, but even when I'm working within genre, try to offer up kind of a more complete picture of these things as a film, not just as a roller coaster ride. And that's one of the main things I try to do with the Video Nasties series, the Nasties review. When you're looking at films like Possession, things like that, or even like Human Experiments, and we'll take that as an example, actually, Human Experiments, which is not the most entertaining film on the planet.
It's
a bit dull, but it does have some interesting stuff going on. Same with Cannibal Man. There's actually kind of like aspects of those films which have something to say. I mean, Human Experiments, for instance, has a and I know some people will kind of cringe when you say it has a certain amount of kind of feminist agenda within it. That's actually highlighted by a couple of very explicit parts within the film. Cannibal Man is gay interest, for instance.
Yeah.
So you've got these kind of social sort of ideas that are being explored within these films quite often. Not always. You've got Zombie Flesh Eaters, which, you know, you could try to sort of crowbar some sort of meaning into, but yeah, it'd be kind of loose.
No point,
you know? I mean, the film we're going to be talking about, a Serbian film, for instance, is often decried as just being a nasty piece of work, but there is very powerful kind of political ideas within it. Salo, again, another film which was treated very similar. Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, that's the other end of the spectrum as well. So you get the people who only want to watch films because they're gory, and then you get the people who decry films because they only see them as gory, or, you know, for their kind of baser elements or whatever.
Yeah, it's that they're attacking it from the same, or at least they're approaching it from the same position, but their conclusions are different. So at least what they're looking for is different. Some people are looking for that, I don't know, heads exploding and limbs coming off and, you know, kind of all that sort of stuff. And they really enjoy it. And then other people go, heads exploding, limbs falling off. That's awful. so you can't please all of the people all the time. But there are plenty of things within the horror genre that are very worthwhile. And I've always thought that, you know, the horror genre, particularly as I've gone through kind of like doing what I do on YouTube, looking at them somewhat more closely with a more formal critical mind, although no, I'm not like kind of like going into massively deep film theory necessarily. Horror has long struck me as being one of those genres that really does have an awful lot more to offer than people imagine. In fact, it's one of those places that you can actually sort of approach subjects that are difficult, controversial, damn right illegal in certain circumstances in certain countries. You know, being gay, for instance, and stuff like that, gay concerns and stuff like that, that you wouldn't be able to approach those subjects in a mainstream film, at least not as clearly and as easily. Because these films are kept on the sidelines somewhat. So they often slip through, and they actually often are given the opportunity to have a lot more social content than the kind of like the mainstream has. And I think that's a really valuable part of horror.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been on YouTube, we've established, for over 12 years since you've been kind of making videos. How has YouTube changed in that time? I mean, assume it has changed at least to a certain extent, but is it a lot? Is it better now, worse? How is it?
Mechanically, it's changed. They've had a push, really, to kind of lean towards more commercial content, which is the biggest thing. I think when I started, it was a lot easier to attract an audience because your stuff wasn't struck down every 5 minutes. It wasn't, you know, kind of you weren't challenged, you weren't marginalized. The algorithm was there to kind of help promote you. As long as you put the right words in the tags and stuff like that, then people would eventually be able to find you. And now, of course, there's a massive shift of mainstream media into YouTube as well, not least when it comes to copyright detection and the automatic bots and all that kind of stuff. But just generally kind of getting your content out there is somewhat stymied. I wouldn't say completely, but it is somewhat stymied. So I think the difference now really is that, you know, YouTube it's more difficult to get the attention, but I don't think the attention was what I was particularly worried about when I began. It took me, you know, a couple of years before I started gaining any kind of traction of doing this sort of stuff. So I guess if I was going to give anyone any advice about doing that sort of stuff these days, it's be aware of copyright law, as boring as that is, and, you know, kind of understand what fair use is and that kind of stuff. That's the really formal shit that we didn't have to worry about so much back in the day. Though Egada was one of the first to actually strike one of my videos down, which was the original Nasty's Review, Cannibal Holocaust Review. And I've had problems with them ever since. And that was crikey, that's going to be about 2011, 2012. second thing is, if you're going to go into YouTube, do it because you want to do it. Don't worry about sort of getting into it for the money and all that kind of stuff. That's, if you go into it planning it as a livelihood, then the chances are you're just going to have misery, you know. So you've got to have that whole kind of passion behind you to do it. And that's what's got to be the key to it. Because if you go into it as a business, then you've got work, you know, you've made your hobby work, which means, you know, you're going to be working hard. You're going to have to be working to a schedule because the algorithms force you onto a schedule if you want to make any kind of money or get any kind of attention. That means, you know, when you're feeling at a low ebb or just, you know, mentally not in the right kind of space, you're not going to be able to do a review very easily. And I think the whole kind of algorithms these days really does kind of tank your quality because of the demands of it. So go into it because you love it. If it gains traction, great. If it doesn't, then you still got your hobby. That's probably the biggest thing. And the only other one I would say is, you know, when people do criticize you, and they will criticize you, I've had everything from kind of like, I don't like your audio to, I want to gut you like the pig in that movie.
oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I've had death threats on several occasions. Shockingly, mostly from Mexico for some reason. I'm not quite sure what that's about. But Mexico does not love me for whatever reason. Jesus. I do have a couple of Mexican followers, I think, who are lovely enough people. But, yeah, it's kind of weird. It's a very strange place. But when you do get the criticisms, it's a process of kind of figuring out, you know, what is valid and what is just somebody blowing off steam. And I've always found one of the useful ways is if you get someone who you're not sure about, who seems overly aggressive, being nice sometimes really calms them down. It either calms them down or it pisses them off. Either way, it's a win. Right.
I've been told as well, asking them like, who hurt you? You know, trying to be kind of overly kind of empathetic and sympathetic, kind of like, you know, it's not me. Something's clearly going on in your life that you feel the need to attack some random person on the internet.
Yeah, you know, I mean, certainly asking yourself that. Is this person just having a bad day? Because we all have a bad day, and some people lash out at the faceless wanker on the internet like myself. I'm not so faceless these days, obviously, but they don't know you, and you might have said something which just kind of upset them a little bit. And yeah, most of the time, I'll just ignore it, really will, just kind of like go, yeah, whatever. I mean, the only thing that bothers me these days is all the sex bots that keep leaving comments. it's like, oh, come on, guys, really? I know it's a review of a Jess Franco film, but, you know, show a little decency.
Well, that's definitely something you didn't have to worry about in 2009, sex bots, definitely. Coming up to the end of the interview now, so I just wanted to throw some kind of quick fire type questions at you just to see kind of what you think. Your most guiltiest pleasure video nasty?
Oh, that's probably Devil Hunter.
Wow. I don't like Devil Hunter. It's very boring to me, but okay.
Devil Hunter's a lot of fun. Bloody Moon's
such a Bloody Moon was going to be my answer, so it's either Bloody Moon or Mardi Gras Massacre as well. Is just such a fun film. It's shit, but it's so kind of fun, and the guy who's the killer in that film is so like he just can't do anything but laugh at him because he's so hilarious as well. So those would be kind of my two kind of suggestions.
Yeah, I mean, you'll notice the two suggestions that I gave there. I mean, Mardi Gras Massacre would be up there as well. But Jess Franco films, and of course, I've got a particular liking for Jess Franco films. Although I'm willing to sort of say there's some Jess Franco films that are, you know, almost entirely unwatchable.
Yeah, you have like a whole series on your channel about Jess Franco, don't you? So is Franco like one of your favourite directors then? Is there a specific reason you wanted to do a series just on his film? Or is it because he's got so fucking many?
I started it because I reviewed about, what, about four or five of his films as part of Section 3 and Nasty's review. And there was just always something there that kind of just put that itch in the back of my head. And I kind of like put out there with my audience, I said, you know what, if there's one Jess Franco film that you would suggest me watch, that would kind of tip how I feel about him, what would it be? And he said, Venus and Furs was one of the main answers. And I kind of went, okay, right. So I watched it and I was blown away by it. Jess Franco is an interesting guy. And he really does epitomize the European horror scene in so many ways. He is clearly an artist. He has a visual style. He has a remarkable ability to photograph women.
Very true.
Absolutely stunning ways. He has a catalog which leans from utter trash to a real piece of art. And a huge, huge catalogue of films as well. In all sorts of genres. He's kind of all over the place. So very much a gun for hire. And I kind of started watching his stuff. And to say the least, he's kind of an acquired taste, to say the least. he really is. I totally understand why people can't get into the stuff. But with the amount of stuff that I've watched of his, I just found a certain charm in what he does. And there's... with so many of his films, there's an apparent joy to what he does. And that's kind of what I sort of keyed in on. And I just watched recently Night of the Eagles.
Okay.
Which is a World War II kind of romantic drama by Jess Franco, right?
Oh, wow. Trying to imagine what that's like.
All the characters that you're following are Nazis. It's really weird. It's so weirdly pitched. But I kind of like went, I was sold when I saw it because they'd just done a release of it. And I was sold when I saw it. It's like Christopher Lee, for one thing, in it. He'd been in quite a few of Jess Franco's films.
Mm.
But it was starring alongside Mark Hamill. And I like, Mark Hamill was in a Jess Franco film. Seriously? and I couldn't buy that fast enough. I mean, as it is, it's a competent film. It's not exactly remarkable, but it is kind of an interesting sort of entry into Jess Franco's filmography, to say the least. But I always had a soft spot for Lena Romay as well, so whatever she was in was kind of all right with me.
That's fair enough. I don't really blame you on that one. Without wanting to go into too much detail on this, because I appreciate this might be a subject that you could talk about for a very long time, one of the things that becomes apparent when you watch certain videos on your channel is you have very strong opinions on censorship when it comes to film. Have those opinions stayed the same kind of since you've been doing the channel? Do you have different views on censorship? Are you more or less for it? I mean, what are your feelings about it today?
I don't think overall the sum total of my kind of opinion has changed that much. My general stance really is that I think classification is important and I think legality is important. So one part of the censorship sort of debate is kind of like, you know, treatment of animals and things like that. And I've seen that sort of play out with like Cannibal Holocaust and stuff like that, and how that film has ended up in the UK with the one cut being the Coat of Monday.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I kind of like, you know, I'm not, you shouldn't censor absolutely anything, but I'm also kind of like, this stuff is for adults as long as it's not been done, you know, via illegal means, whether they've filmed, you know, kind of staged and filmed murders and that kind of stuff. Clearly, that stuff should be censored if they went and did that. But there's laws that kind of govern a lot of the crimes that would happen as a part of filmmaking. I'm all for the BBFC sort of like going, right, okay, this is an 18 or 15. And although they've kind of shifted position recently to some degree. Mm. They seem to be going backpedaling a little bit just recently. But I think that's good for consumer, from a consumer's position, in that they inform you of what kind of age these things are suitable for. I think that's fine. It gives the consumer a kind of a rough guide as to what it is they're about to expose themselves to. Because I'm not a big one for like kind of surprising people with that. I mean, you could say Cannibal Holocaust is a jungle adventure film, and that could mean everything from Indiana Jones to, well, Cannibal Holocaust. So yeah. Having that information is kind of important. But when it comes to films like the ones that we're about to talk about, then you start to get into the nitty-gritty of the law. And that's really kind of like where the BBFC do kind of occasionally cross the line.
We'll go into that more kind of when we talk about Serbian film in more detail. I noticed that in your channel now, you tend to do a lot more kind of live streaming and a lot of watch-alongs compared to doing like just kind of videos.
Yeah.
Is that like a conscious decision? Is it for time reasons? Because I must appreciate, I've never done it myself, but it must take a while to make a video. I don't know if you script your videos or what the process is, but anyway, do you stream more just to save time, so you actually have time to do stuff?
At the this past year, what with, you know, the current ongoing situation, so we avoid the YouTube algorithm, it was as much a case of just where I've been mentally, apart from anything else. There's been a lot of pressure on, and certainly earlier on I was kind of spending an awful lot of time in front of the computer just doing work, not the reviewing work. I mean work as in day job. And it was just getting hard to be creative, because, you know, when you spend 8 hours in front of a computer, you don't want to be spending another 2 or 3 hours a day kind of sitting in front of a computer writing. You know, so yeah. It started off with that, that I kind of went, okay, I still want my audience to be able to have something coming towards them. So I kind of went, well, let's do, you know, some live streams, do some watch-alongs. We find a video and we sit down and we kind of watch it together and chat about that and other things. And it was entirely about them. It wasn't about me. I mean, I could have sat on my ass and watched, you know, one of the many videos behind me. But it was just a nice way to sort of kind of, at least I felt it was a nice way to give something back to the community and allow them to have something to look forward to, especially in the early days of lockdown, because everybody was stuck in their homes and just like kind of get to Saturday night. They were normally going out to a pub and stuff like that. So I kind of went, well, let's do a little something. And it kind of just rolled over the year, and I'm trying to get myself back into writing again now that things are sort of settling down. I just started a review of a film called Carriers, which I've got to try to kind of get my arse in gear with. I've done like about a page and a half of the script for it. And yeah, I mean, the writing thing is actually sort of coming back. I do to some degree prefer doing like formal reviews, because I like the product at the end of it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
But the live streams are fun, and they're nice, and it's a nice way to reach out to my audience and just give them a little chance for an outlet.
Exactly. And last question, this is very kind of inside. This might not mean anything to, well, anyone who hasn't seen your early videos. Why did you stop doing zombie fingers out of 10 in all your videos, bro?
The reason was I found people who were commenting were concentrating too much on the score. And it's like, you know, and I kind of thought about it now. I sort of went, that's not helpful. Because I knew that I was saying a lot about the film within the reviews, and I wanted that to be the impression, not what my ultimate rather subjective opinion of the score was. Plus, I kind of went, I feel a little unreliable with doing that, because on one day a film might be 4, another day it might be 6. So I was a bit like, kind of like, I didn't really want to kind of continue that. And so I just went, I'll just let the review speak for itself. And I found that a lot more helpful, not just to me, but it allowed people to make their own conclusions to a higher degree. A lot of people were really upset about the zombie fingers going.
Nah, I'm not really. I just, I don't know. I just thought it was curious. That's all. It just tickled me. I got why you got rid of it, and I totally understand your reasons, but I don't know. I just thought it'd be funny to ask.
Yeah, you're not the first.
Ah, sorry. So yeah, no, thank you for doing this. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Get to talk about a Serbian film now. Are you excited to talk about a Serbian film again?
I didn't think I would be talking about it again, but I think it's one of those films that I've grown an appreciation for, and I wasn't sure what to think of it the first time I saw it. I had a feeling when I first started watching it, that there was something a bit more to this film than kind of like just what everybody was complaining about. Because it got a lot of complaints, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to talk about that in a second. So, yeah, stay tuned, because coming up after this, it's mine and Glenn's review of a Serbian film. Serbian film was directed by Srđan Spasojević, and it came out in 2010. Now, Srđan Spasojević has only made a Serbian film and one other short film, which is part of the ABCs of Death, which I talked about on a previous episode of this series a couple of years ago. Now, I am joined, in case you are coming into this on YouTube and you haven't been listening to the podcast, by Lampyman 101, Glenn Criddle.
That's me. So, it's all going fine.
Awesome. So, Glenn, have you seen the ABCs of Death?
No, I haven't. Although I had actually, just because of doing this, looked up the director's name again, and just to see what other stuff he was doing. And yes, that came up, and I was about to watch it, and then I had to kind of apply for a Shudder account if I was going to go watch it on Prime.
Okay, well, I do actually recommend Shudder. Shudder of the streaming services is actually quite good. It's better if you have a VPN, but for if you want horror, then it's a good place to go. But yeah, on the ABCs of Death, Spasojević did one of the short films called Arthur Removed. And it's very allegorical. I mean, people talk about a Serbian film as allegorical. I think his experience making and the response to a Serbian film has inflected, shall we say, this short film. So the plot for what there is a man is continually subjected to constant surgeries as his skin can produce full rolls of 35mm film. He's covered in bandages but seemingly adored by the public who want to touch his skin. Eventually, his skin begins to produce less and less film and he escapes, killing several men in the process. Incidentally, he kills one of them by kind of making him drown in shit, essentially. Which is, yeah, is what
it sounds like. Apaches.
Yeah. He makes it to a train yard and crushes himself underneath one of the cars. Shortly afterwards, it begins to rain blood. There's no dialogue, incidentally. So what it means is entirely kind of like well, up to the viewer, shall we say. Is that sound like something that you'd be interested in?
Definitely, I'll be checking it out, because I think it's just worth to see, apart from anything else, the stylistic elements, if they carry over from a Serbian film into that, is one of the things I'd be interested in. Because, I mean, a Serbian film for me, the production quality and all that kind of stuff is outstanding. It is an incredibly well shot film. So I'd be interested to see if that translates into a short film.
The only other thing I was going to say about Arthur Removed is, so Film School Rejects, their website, they made an article of 25 things we learned from the commentary of the ABCs of Death. And of Arthur Removed, they've said, Spasiewicz's commentary consists entirely of some kind of weird, bleak performance art poetry. It actually pairs up to some degree with the short, but while they look and sound interesting, neither make a lick of sense.
I think it's one of the risks of short filmmaking. You've got such a small canvas to be painting your picture on, that it's a completely separate art form from like kind of feature length filmmaking in some respects. You've got to do that really abridged kind of thing. I've had a certain amount of that with reviewing in print format. You know, you've got a very small window in which to actually express your opinion. And I imagine that's a similar situation when it comes to making a 6-minute short that you want to cram a lot into.
Yeah, it's very true. I imagine it's quite hard to tell like a complete story in a short space of time. So anyone who does it, they have my admiration, definitely, 100%. But yeah, as I said, to date, the only film that he's made in full is a Serbian film, which, as I said, came out in 2010. So before we talk about the film itself in detail, everyone watching or listening to this will know the synopsis of a Serbian film anyway. But Glenn, if you would not mind telling everyone kind of just the general story of a Serbian film.
Okay, yeah. It centres around a character called Miloš, who is a retired or at least semi-retired porn star. He's approached by his former agent to get involved in a new artistic form of porn. And the pay packet that comes from this particular film is incredibly high, and he's running out of money. He's got a family to support, so he kind of almost reluctantly decides that he's going to do it. Now, he's introduced to this director, Vukmir, who keeps the project very mysterious. And after looking into Vukmir's history, Miloš finds out that his past is somewhat mysterious. There are elements of his life, like he was a psychiatric worker at a children's orphanage in his past. And then he went into children's TV and then just disappeared. And nobody's heard of him since until he just pops his head up to make this new project with Miloš. And basically Miloš is dragged into this kind of seamy underworld of very, very dark pornography, which becomes incredibly uncomfortable in terms of the things that are actually happening within it. And not just that, just the mysterious nature of what it is he's actually filming. And basically he gets dragged down further and further and further until he's kind of goes from being a willing participant into being a victim, someone who is drugged and coerced into completing this project. That's the crux of the film.
Yeah. So that's the overriding story. And to be honest, like, the story itself doesn't really matter in a lot of ways, and I'm going to kind of go into that sort of when we talk about the film in sort of more great depth a bit later on in this review. Now, one of the reasons I specifically wanted to do this episode with you, Glenn, is this film, as a lot of people watching or listening will know, is this film is quite heavily cut in the UK. So it's been cut by the BBFC, and originally it was meant to be shown at Frightfest in 2010. And you actually went to that Fright Fest, didn't you? And you made a blog about it.
Yes, I did an immediate response because one of the things, I was actually invited down for two things. One was the a Serbian film screening because the distributors, the UK distributors of the Blu-ray and DVD, Revolver, were interested in having me go down and see this film. The other one was the directors of The Dead asked me to go and see their film. But initially, it was because of a Serbian film. And I went down, and as I remember, it was on the day that they decided that they weren't going to show it because they were relying on the Greater London Council actually sort of giving them a waiver for any BBFC certificate to show the uncut version. But the GLC basically turned around and says, we're going with the BBFC. And they required, like, what was it, 4 minutes and 11 seconds of cuts? And Frightfest basically says, we're not doing that. So they changed the film.
Yeah. So on my last podcast that I did, Paul McAvoy came on the show to talk about Frightfest in 2018. Mm-hmm. And that was actually one of the questions that I asked him about when he came on, because I knew I didn't go to the Frightfest in 2010, but like I asked him about sort of, you know, that whole situation. And yeah, he basically said what you said just then, like, you know, they were told they had to cut the film. He didn't want to cut it, or they, I suppose, the four organizers didn't want to cut it. And so, yeah, they just ended up not showing it. When we talk about a Serbian film and censorship, can you see why the BBFC cut it? And do you think the film should have been censored at all, in your opinion?
I can understand why they did, although it's not the most flattering reason. The BBFC is supposed to be somewhat removed from the emotional impact that a film has on them specifically. They bear a certain amount of that in mind. And of course, they're human beings, it will colour their decisions and all that kind of stuff. But the central crux of what they're supposed to look at is supposed to be the law. And I don't think a Serbian film classifies as legally obscene. And some lawyers have pretty much kind of said that it's not legally obscene. If it went to an obscenity trial, the chances are it would get through quite happily, although it might upset a few people along the way. The BBFC have always had this thing in mind, though, and it's happened on a few occasions, particularly kind of post-Furman, where they're worried that if they do release it, that the kickback on them would be too much to take. And that's all down to the, you know, the Video Recordings Act. If the Home Office like kind of went, yeah, there's too much of a stink being kicked up, they may have made, you know, legally the right decision, but we can kick them out and get somebody else in. There's always that one section of the Video Recordings Act that allows the Home Office just to reappoint. And that could literally be the beginning of the end for the BBFC. So they have that sword of Damocles hanging over their head. And I think that that probably played in to a certain extent. The other thing is they also have that whole kind of, they have to bear in mind the public's sensibilities and whether or not the general public would be able to kind of watch out without being upset by it. And considering some of the content, mentioning no very specific pornography that's partially displayed within the film, that would have been quite a difficult thing for them to sit and justify. Where, like I say, regardless of whether they're right or wrong, they've also got to justify their decisions in the eyes of people who aren't cinephiles, you know, and critics. So do I understand their decision? I can understand their reticence. Should the film have been censored? I don't think so. I mean, I've only watched the uncut version, and as strong as it is, I don't see anything there which is intrinsically harmful, because apart from anything else, the way stuff is presented is presented in a non-glorifying kind of way. Now, the BBFC would say differently. They would say that it sexualizes certain types of violence. There is sex and there is violence. If you're of a, you know, normal frame of mind, there's nothing in that film that I think will make you distracted, shall we say.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah, okay. So I do get that, and I kind of like you, and this might be just the result of, you know, maybe we both have PTSD from watching sort of too many kind of disturbing, violent films. But yeah, I'm with you. There's nothing you can point at in the film and say that, okay, this makes sense as to why it should have been cut or whatever. Because even with, like, say, the newborn porn scene, for example, when you describe it, it sounds a lot worse than what it actually is. And it is clear kind of what is going on. But I think the film itself is not saying, isn't this great? The main character, Milosh, he is disgusted by it. And because he's the protagonist and he's our kind of point of view of what's happening in the film as an audience, I would say that, yeah, it's like, yes, there is something bad happening, but the film's not justifying it to me. Does that make sense?
It's quite the opposite of justification as well.
Yeah.
It's one of the central points that the character realizes quite what the hell it is he's got into. And he's absolutely revolted. You know, he wants nothing to do with it. He didn't really want anything to do with it before then. And the fact that this guy has shown his hand of cards at that point, to that extent, he immediately walks out. It's like, there's no kind of like, oh, look at this. This is great. You know, it shows that character of Vukmir for what he is, a particularly nasty piece of work. It's not glorifying anything.
No.
And it, you know, technically, yeah, I mean, you can't say justify no cuts by saying technically it doesn't show anything. I mean, it is a powerful scene. There's no two ways about it. It's quite disgusting. But it's not done in a way that's kind of like, oh, hey, lads, you know, kind of like nudge, nudge. It doesn't work like that. In fact, I don't think any part of the film does that. Even the regular, well, I mean, obviously it's not kind of explicit, but the porn scenes with Milosh in his earlier days and that kind of stuff, even that has a sheen of grime to it. It's not particularly provocative.
Although those scenes, you know, if we're taking this universe that the film is presenting to us literally, these are the tamest porn scenes ever. You don't even get any insert shots or anything. Like, Jess Franco, if he made this film, you know he'd be all up in there, like, you know.
Oh, there'd be close-ups. There'd be, like, nice loving kind of zooms. I mean, there is a difference between the kind of sex that's shown in something like a Jess Franco film, which tends to be, for the most part, pretty tender. For the most part, even when it's inappropriate to be doing that. Because he's very liberated sexually. He kind of he loves the act. He loves the women. He loves all that kind of stuff. And he's very, very attentive when it comes to that kind of stuff, to the point of inappropriateness at certain points. What a Serbian film does is, it's ugly, and it makes no bones about it being ugly. It's intentionally ugly. It's cold. It's harsh. It's very often animalistic. There's that scene where Milos is in bed with his wife. She sort of turns to him and says, like, why don't you take me like those other girls? And he does, and it's astonishingly uncomfortable, very, very close to being rape. The scene sort of shifts and he goes back to being kind of like how he would be with his wife, at which point she's happy, you know. So it's not like the film ever kind of presents that sort of stuff as being attractive. It's dangerous. It's nasty. It's rough and violent. In that respect, I don't know how the BBFC got any right to sort of say it sexualizes the violence, because there is sex, there is violence, but it's not alluring. Yeah, it's not alluring in any kind of way. At least not to me. I mean, you can always say that, you know, there'll be, like Mary White said, there's always going to be some nutter having a watch of good violence, as you might call it. yes, of course you're going to get those elements. But when it comes down to it, those people are a tiny, tiny minority. And they're the sort of people that will sexualize anything. If that stuff didn't exist, they would find something to latch onto. You're kind of fighting a losing battle. And there's always that apocryphal example I give of the kid who killed himself because he couldn't be Simba from the Lion King.
Oh, wow. Really?
And Yeah, I had heard that and I had seen it written down somewhere. I've not been able to find it anywhere since, but which is why I always say it's apocryphal. It's kind of like I can't evidence that, but there are people who will fixate on fantasy, whether it's kind of like a, I don't know, like a furry community, fixate on the strangest stuff, in my opinion. But, you know, you're doing that over there, you're doing it out of my way, I got no problem with that. You know, as long as you're not doing anything illegal, you're fine. You just, you dress up as Sonic the Hedgehog.
Nothing wrong dressing up as Sonic the Hedgehog. Oh dear. On a more serious subject than that, though, so as you mentioned, you made a video about a Serbian film not too long after it came out. It was called Serbian Film, An Analysis and a Defense. Has your opinion of the film changed since you kind of last saw it? So it was 2009 that you would have seen it, wouldn't it? Or was it 2010?
2010.
Okay.
I think I saw it. I saw it after Fright Fest. Has my opinion changed on that? The one thing I would say about that video is it didn't go into a lot of the details that I would kind of go into now. I still think that there is a very worthwhile narrative. I still think it's very allegorical. I think things like the use of sex in the film it is violent sex within the film, and it runs as an allegory for violence. And there are questions to be asked about, you know, kind of like the whole sort of porn scene. What does that represent something, you know, kind of that isn't the porn scene? And I kind of think that as well. There'd be tiny little details, I think, within that video particularly that I would probably voice differently at the very least, if not more completely.
Okay. I find it interesting that you did use the term defense as well, because I do, looking back at the time, because I, just peeling back the curtain a little bit, I first watched a Serbian film just around the time that the whole Fright Fest furore was going on, because it was surprisingly easy to find for such a controversial film. And I watched it, and I can't remember what my thoughts were, but it didn't kind of leave me disturbed in the way that something like Martyrs did when I first saw Martyrs at about a similar time. And did you call it a defense because all these kind of people were kind of against it, saying it should be banned, you know, and that kind of stuff? Is that why you use the term a defense? Or is it that you thought people were misreading the film? They're only seeing it just for the violent shit, basically.
I think people reacted very viscerally to it. And I totally understand that, because it is one of those films that sort of smacks you in the face with an awful lot of very difficult stuff. But I do remember an awful lot of reviews, or at least commentary, on the film that was going around. And I saw very, very, very little, if none, of any kind of, this is what the film may have been going for. There was just a lot of focus on the newborn porn scene, for instance, and the fact that children appear in several scenes and things like that, and how disgusting and how depraved that was and all that kind of stuff. And it sort of harks back an awful lot to the kind of reaction to the video nasties at the time in the early 80s. So when I kind of did that thing and I said it's an analysis and a defense, it was just, I mean, like I say, the review itself is not as complete by a long shot as I would like it to have been. In fact, I might even revisit it at some point and do a more complete kind of overlook of the film. But the defense kind of side of it was really, just look at this film once again, please, and just sort of try to appreciate the fact that there is things going on and it isn't just outright kind of throwing this stuff at you just to shock you.
Exactly. Do you think when Spasijevic, in interviews, he says that, you know, when he made a Serbian film, or when he was making it, I suppose I should say, that he didn't think about kind of how audiences would react to some of the material, and he didn't go out of his way to shock people. Do you believe him?
I think it's hard to say because I can't be in his mind. I'm willing to believe that he made what he felt he needed to make, and he might not have thought out all the ramifications of what he was doing. But for him to sort of say, yeah, the newborn porn scene was never going to ruffle a few feathers would be naive, to say the least.
Incredibly.
You know, you've got to have some kind of expectation when you do something like that, that the general audience, you know, the vast majority of your audience is going to have a tough time with it. I don't think a scene like that, even if it was done even milder than it was done in that, would still cause problems. So I would say, you know, at the, if I'm being very, very charitable, I would have to say he was being incredibly naive.
Yeah, yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And I would agree. I personally, you know, hey, the guy comes across so sincere in all his interviews about kind of the film that, yeah, I assume he kind of must have gone into it in a similar way. And I was going to ask you about this, actually. So we're talking about basically anything to do with children, mm-hmm. or anything kind of sexuality in children is a massive kind of hot button issue. Did you follow the Cuties controversy from like a year or two ago?
No, I didn't see that.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know, basically Cuties was this film, it was a French film, and it's essentially about this group of girls who are sort of underage. I think they're meant to be like 11 or 12, and they want to be kind of popular. And their idea of doing that is sort of taking part in this sort of dance contest, and they practice. And a lot of the dance moves they're doing are quite provocative, because they're obviously meant to be done originally by adults. So there's a lot of kind of grinding and twerking and things of that nature. And the film was meant to be like a warning about sexualization of young girls, essentially. That's what the director's intention was when they made it. It then got bought by Netflix. Incidentally, when it came out in the festival circuit, there was no kind of controversy whatsoever. You know, it was just a film that came out like, you know, all others. And then it got to Netflix, and the marketing material that Netflix used ruffled a lot of people the wrong way, particularly when it comes to America, because, you know, you can read between the lines on this, but American sort of morality is very different from like European morality, particularly when it comes to anything vaguely sexual. And when you've got sort of children as well, see, you know, QAnon, stuff like that, all that kind of stuff, it becomes like, oh my God, we must protect the children at all costs. So even though the director's intentions were good and worthy, it got released to, you know, general public on Netflix to millions upon millions of people. And, you know, some random person who's not a cinephile in like the middle of America somewhere goes, you know, my God, you know, they're sexualizing young girls here or whatever. I don't know. I don't know why I did that accent, by the way. But yeah, you get the idea.
Mm.
So my point is, the reason I bring that up is because there's, you know, a lot of kind of, what's the word I'm looking for here? But like paranoia about kind of all our children being exploited in this film, and the way that children are used, you know, not literally, but it's the way that the images are cut together in a certain way. Do you think that's something that's happened here?
I think when it comes to the kind of childhood stuff that happens in a Serbian film, a lot of people focus on very specific parts of it. The counter to that really is kind of the scene where Miloš and his wife are talking to the son about his feelings, his kind of clearly sort of burgeoning sexual kind of feelings. Mm. And it's done in such a kind of liberal and warm way. It's like, yeah, okay, this is not an unnatural thing for you to feel. Da, 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 da. They don't encourage him along that line, but they certainly kind of try to go, okay, this is just something you have to, you know, eventually explore. Da, da, da. Good, actually, kind of almost a model of how you would talk, should talk to kids about those kind of things, instead of going, it's dirty, hide it away. which is, you know, particularly in America, seems to be kind of one of those things. You have the abstinence only kind of stuff going on. So, but then you contrast that against the scenes where Miloš is performing and there's the Alice in Wonderland girl sat across the room. So the kind of depictions of youth and sexuality is very, very different. I mean, it's not really like the son is kind of like, you know, a willing participant in that. It's just life kind of happening. I don't know. I sort of vaguely remember what you were talking about and, you know, kind of like the warning of the sexuality of children and all that kind of stuff. With a Serbian film, it's more a case of sexuality. Sex itself is kind of one of those allegories for violence within this, and it is also one of those alluring things within the film, and it's used as a weapon basically, one way or another, and the kids are just kind of dragged along for the ride in that, shall we say. It's kind of interesting when you look at like the Alice in Wonderland girl, who's a recurring character throughout the film, as is her mother, and then you've got another bit which is with her mother, so you got like the grandmother, the daughter, and the kid, and they're sort of they're there for a reason, and that reason is really this sort of generational continuation of this kind of violence which is going on and this exploitation, and so it kind of makes it very, very clear that this is not right, it's not normal. None of that stuff is kind of put in there just for titillation. There's damn solid reasons why it's very explicit about what is going on. Even in, when it comes to the newborn porn thing, it's kind of it's there for this whole kind of cradle to the grave thing, which is supported by, you know, when you get to see the grandmother, you know, she goes, just like it was like with me and my father. Yeah. You know, it's a generational kind of thing going on. And when you certainly kind of like take that analogy of sex and violence actually being kind of, or should I say, sex is a stand-in for violence within the film, within the narrative, a lot of that stuff starts to make a bit more sense in terms of there's this sort of generational perpetuation of this stuff that's going on. And, you know, you'll be old enough to remember when the war happened over there and all that kind of stuff.
I do. Slobodan Milosevic and all that.
Yeah, and Karadzic and so on and so forth. That was a long-running thing, you know. I mean, that's been going on for generations upon generations. It's really, that was the culmination of all these stresses and strains within society. And that's the thing. I think one of the real kind of like manipulative bits of this film, if you like, if you want to be uncharitable, is the fact that he did use sex as violence. It's one of those things that's very provocative, very very much grabs your attention.
Yeah,
and, especially when you start transferring those kind of qualities onto youth. It becomes deeply uncomfortable. And it is always funny with America, you know, you kind of look at the how America deals with anything like that. It's very hypocritical a lot of the time.
Agreed.
Yeah, you look back at the days when films like Porky's and Revenge of the Nerds were kind of going around, and you see kind of like the sexual politics of that kind of stuff, where it was all right because it's just a bit of cheeky kind of like, you know.
Just lads, isn't it?
Exactly. And they're all too happy to kind of sexualize kids. They have the beauty pageants and all that kind of stuff where they get dressed up like a dog's dinner. you know, they'll go, oh, no, it's just because it's pretty. It's not sexual. Really? You're trying to make a 6-year-old look like they're kind of like, you know, older.
Yeah, same thing was brought up when the cuties controversy was going on about the whole beauty pageants thing. Yeah, I would say I'm not good with allegories. Okay, I've got like literally hundreds of DVDs. I've watched loads of films. I am shit when it comes to stuff like allegories and kind of being able to read films and stuff like that. But even I could kind of tell you what the allegory of this film kind of is, because it's pretty obvious. So you've got Vukmir, he's like a stand-in for kind of like authority figures in Serbia, and you've got Marko, Miloš's brother, you know, he's in the police, he's corrupt, you know, pretty obvious what's going on there. And even like a lot of the things that happen in a lot of ways, it's like, okay, you know, newborn porn. So you're fucked from the point that you're born. You're fucked when you're born. You're fucked when you die as well. Cause hence what happens at the end of the film as well. And like you mentioned, Glenn, with like the whole, like the grandmother, and it's like perpetuating the same kind of abuses over and over and over again as the generations go. So all that, I think, is fairly obvious. And I would say that, you know what, from a technical perspective, the film is really well made. I mean, I was happy to see, you know, put the film on, hadn't seen it in God knows how many years, saw it, and it's like, my God, there's actual colours in the film. So, Glenn, you probably won't know this. The last film that I watched before I did this review was Grotesque, which I know you've reviewed. And I hated Grotesque with a passion because it's really ugly looking and it's like everything just looks brown or dark. So when I watch this and it's like, oh my God, I can actually see colours. And it's like, you know, the second half of the film in particular is like really well stylized. You know, I think visually kind of it demonstrates like, you know, when Milos is drugged and he's going through like all the stuff that he goes through in the second half of the film. I think it does that really well. You know, it's got quite a good dream sequence in there. And yeah, so visually, the way it's directed, great. No problems with that. It's actually, you know, very good. Top tier, I think. Would you agree?
Yes, it is an incredibly well-produced film. I think it's a very well-directed film in many respects. I think the biggest challenge with that film is probably certain decisions on how far they went with certain things. I think that's the biggest challenge of it, is it's that there are certain parts where they just go so far that they're going to leave people behind. That's always a shame when it happens, but it's also kind of like, you know, it's artistic expression. The director should go as far as they feel they need to go. But you can't also sort of stand there and complain about, I lost so much of the audience, or, you know, people misunderstood it when you're showing them that kind of stuff. It's not easy for people to really get their heads around that kind of stuff. It's like being slapped in the face and then being asked to understand why.
It's pretty much
very difficult. But it is a beautifully filmed film, considering, you know, the ugliness that it shows.
And that is my point. My point is that, yeah, the film looks great. You know, it's well directed. If you wanted to, you could make literally the same film with the same allegorical content, you know, even make it about porn, still have pretty much even very, very similar kind of story to that. But unfortunately, and this is my biggest issue with the film, is Spasiewicz and his writer, whose name escapes me at the moment, they do not understand subtlety in the slightest. Like, it's just, there's an absurd lack of subtlety in this film. And I'm not even talking about stuff like newborn porn, which is like the most literal thing in cinema, like, ever. Or, you know, a man fucking his own son, quite frankly. Like, I'm not even talking about that. What I'm talking about is even things like the sort of subplot with the brother and Milos's wife. Mm-hmm. Like, literally, it's so, like, absurdly, like, overdone. So it's like, even from the very start of the film, the brother mentions to Milos that, oh, you've got a beautiful wife. And then, you know, he's overly sexually aggressive with Layla, like, you know, his Milos's, like, former co-star in porn. And then there's the scene, which is ridiculous, where he goes to their house. You know, he's just having a chat with Milos's wife and she's eating an apple, and it's all very suggestive. Like, she knows blatantly that, like, he wants to fuck her, quite frankly. And she's kind of like, yeah, you're an idiot, I don't like you. And he goes off and he just has a wank in the bathroom. And even later on, when he's like watching like this home video of like Milos's son's birthday party, and he's getting a blowjob from, I think it's meant to be an escort or a prostitute or something, and it's just, it's like so ridiculously like unsubtle. It's just,
I think it's a bit of a mix of two things, really. Yes, there is the very blatant stuff that is going on, but you know, it kind of poses questions, not least because, what, for one thing, he's impotent, right? That's one thing that's kind of like brought up on a couple of occasions. He only kind of, he sort of covets the family. He covets his brother's family. And he's a police officer. He clearly can get beautiful girls, but he can't get it up for them. And the only time that he can actually get any gratification is from that little slice of normality that he can't have. So there are more subtle things going on within that, but it's this wall of just kind of like really overt violence and sex and kind of like grotesqueness, which sort of slams you in the face, which kind of you can kind of miss some of the smaller things that are going on. It's like with Vukmir, his name. I did a little bit of research and I don't know how accurate it is. But his name translates to Vuk is wolf and peace. Mir is peace. So it's wolf peace. So you've got these two kind of like violence and peace.
Kind of thing going on. Vukmir.
Yeah.
Apparently as well. So it's hilarious.
There are things like that going on. I'm not going to say they're like they're super subtle, but there are things which are going on a little bit under the surface. You are faced with this sort of tsunami of nastiness right in front of it, and then having to focus through that to kind of like the smaller waves behind that. You know, you start like, this huge wave of this stuff which is crushing you. And you got to focus on this other stuff which is going on in the background as well. But no, it's not the most subtle of films by any means. But I think there are subtleties to it. It's just they're kind of smothered somewhat. And I think that is, it's that whole thing of the, you know, the directorial voice kind of shouting. You kind of get lost in the violence of that shouting and not hearing the words.
Yeah, pretty much. I'm going to refer to, for the benefit of Glenn and the audience, I have a section of my show called Reviews from the Outer Rim. And this kind of ties into kind of what I'm talking about with Glenn now. This is from a Letterboxd user called Eli Hayes, who has unfortunately since writing this review passed away. But it does kind of sum up my thoughts of the film quite well in regards to sort of allegory and kind of lack of subtlety and things like that. And it goes as follows. So it says, this film really only has one problem, but unfortunately for Serjan Spasojevich, it's a huge problem. Underneath all of the violence and depravity and insanity, there is a film with an important message to send not only about the porn industry, but the entertainment industry in general, how far some individuals are willing to go for cash in this money-driven world that we have created, and general inhuman wickedness or perversion. Nonetheless, that's not what this film is going to be remembered for, and that's its biggest flaw. It dives so deeply into its own transgressive, grotesque underworld that most people aren't going to be able to view this film for its message, only for its violence. And that's not good. That's a sign of approaching an issue in the wrong manner. I salute Mr. Spasojevich for attempting to tackle such a controversial subject matter, but I wish he could have gone about it in a little bit different of a way. I look forward to seeing what this director will do in the future, but next time, I just hope he takes it down a notch. This is not a bad film by any means, but aside from the cinematography and the score, especially, not sure about that bit personally, but whatever, it's not a great one either. There's indeed a method to Spasojevich's madness, but in my opinion, the method needs revision. Glenn, your thoughts?
I disagree slightly with the reading of what the film's about, although you can absolutely read that into it. However, I think it's pretty much said what I said in terms of it's a film that the message gets lost in the volume that it's being told at. That's always exactly a problem. Again, Salo is the go-to example. It's a film that is extraordinarily angry to the point of kind of losing some coherence in the anger. The anger's justified, don't get me wrong, but it needs to be a bit more kind of clearly stated. And I think that is always going to be the problem with a Serbian film going forward, is that people don't hear the message for the megaphone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is it the part where you're talking about how it's about the porn industry? Because that seems to be something that people have picked up after the fact. It's not something that Spasojevich himself has mentioned in interviews. He said that it's about political correctness. And by that, he doesn't mean it in the way that most people mean it. He means like films made in Serbia, in his opinion, are only funded because they're about kind of poor people, or they're about kind of people who are oppressed by war. And you know, all that kind of stuff, or it's about kind of, you know, modern Serbia, essentially. He hasn't said anywhere that it's about the porn industry. This is something that other people have kind of said that they think it's about.
I think people are reading it very surface level. I think that kind of the porn industry and the characters within it, be it Vukmir, be it the bald guy, be it you know, kind of Milos or his brother, all these characters are kind of like, there's this sort of authoritarian kind of structure going on there. So you've got this almost kind of like political kind of structure which is going on. Vukmir himself reports to somebody else who's a mysterious kind of character, looks kind of like a government official, as a for instance. But it is, I mean, it's going to sound terribly big-headed to say this. Many people kind of take the film at face value. And they take a lot of films at face value.
Yeah, I would say it's more that than this film specifically.
Yeah. So when it comes to a film like this, and because it's the porn industry particularly, people have, I mean, it's very eye-catching, this thing that's going on. It's very kind of like grabs your attention, the fact that it's the porn industry and the kind of like sort of things that go on with it and the kind of players that play within it. And it's very easy to get kind of dominated by that thought, that because that's the setting, that's what it's about.
Mm.
And I think there's a bit more going on than that. I think there's a lot more going on than that. I think he sort of said that the director had mentioned that it's, you know, there's a commentary on media, which, yes, there's certainly something of that. But I kind of interpret that from my own kind of like looking at the film. There's a sort of like kind of indoctrination going on, and certainly is with the character, you know, kind of like Milos goes from being an honest guy. He does a kind of extraordinary job, to say the least.
Yeah.
But he's kind of dragged into this world sort of bit by bit, this darker kind of version of the job that he had. It's kind of goes from being kind of like regular porn to this sort of snuff. He's via several steps, and he's kind of indoctrinated but step by step, till it gets to a point where he's almost kind of like woken up and starts to realize quite what he's involved in. And if you sort of transpose kind of like violence to sex, and, you know, bearing in mind the history of the country with 10 years before that was, you know, at war and facing kind of trials at The Hague and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then you start to kind of like, it always sounds like a little bit of a leap to people, but it's like kind of like, this is the mindset where where the filmmaker would be coming from to some extent. This is a big part of his life. So, yeah, I don't think it's too big a leap to sort of say that there is that transposition of violence to sex and kind of like, and that Vukmir and the rest of them are kind of like this sort of authority kind of structure. So saying it's just about the porn industry, yes, overtly it is. But, you know, on a deeper reading of it, it becomes kind of like just an allegory for another kind of structure, which, you know, I would suggest is the government and authority figures of the recent history.
Yeah. Is that a problem in that a lot of the people who are going to be viewing this are, let's say, Western audiences who only know about the film because it's controversial and they're not interested in the specific issues that are going on in Serbia that the film addresses, let's put it that way? It's going to go completely over their heads, basically.
Well, I would give you another example, which is Men Behind the Sun. It's a film that very easily, when you look at it, it can just seem as being kind of an extreme gore film. And it is. It's very graphic. Even by today's standard, you know, it's quite upsetting. Nanjing Massacre, Black Sun, another example. Both of those films are very, very, very accurate in terms of history. They're a lot less allegorical, but if you're not aware of things like the Nanjing Massacre or Unit 731, those films come across as being very, very different films with very different purpose. And to some degree, I think a Serbian film has that, because people aren't particularly aware or haven't experienced the kind of history, recent history that Serbia had. So some of these expressions, some of these kind of potential allegories, whether the director meant it or not, sometimes these things are more important than you would imagine, and can completely change the complexion of the film. Particularly like say, Men Behind the Sun is, I did a pretty in-depth video on that, just exploring the history.
Yeah, I remember.
It's quite upsetting to research.
I'm not fucking surprised. Jesus. Yeah. Although that does actually kind of tie into something that I've always said, in that you've talking about, you know, Men Behind the Sun, you don't think it has any allegorical content to it. I think there's a tendency, particularly in film analysis, to kind of go, well, this film is an allegory for XYZ, therefore it's good. It completely ignoring the actual content of the film itself. So I'm going to mention it again, everybody. So when I talked about Hostel, one of the issues I had with Hostel is that Eli Roth said, well, this film, it's an allegory for commodification and exploitation and, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. But people took that to mean, well, it's good because it's about those things, kind of ignoring the actual content of the film itself. Mm-hmm. And with a Serbian film, although, as I've already mentioned, I think the film is very well made and it has an allegory, and the allegory is a little bit more meaningful than the one what Eli Roth mentioned for Hostel. But at the same time, it's like, okay, you get to a point where you've got a man basically being fucked to death through his eye socket.
It's like, that is one of the more ludicrous moments, to give it, to be fair.
The allegory is kind of lost at that point, quite frankly.
I think that particular moment, and certainly, you know, as it gets towards the end, it does get even more outrageous. That is the, you know, clearly the silliest moment of the thing. But I think, you know, where the film goes in general, that moment aside, although you can make an argument for that moment, even, it just feels very, very ridiculous. I think it is kind of ridiculous, but, I think the things that that's touching on are far more interesting and nuanced than something like Hostel is. I think Hostel is a very broad film at best. It's it's not terribly pointed. It's kind of getting an idea from something that has happened in the past. And that's about as far as it goes. It's not really about commodification in anything other than the most broad of sense. It's like, kind of like, yeah, they're paying to kill these people.
Mm.
And what context is that in? You know, that's the kind of thing that a Serbian film has, kind of like a historical and social context. Hostel doesn't. It's really kind of like taking an outrageous thing and kind of like going, look, you know, look at this thing. Look at it closely. These people are buying these people, and that's about as far as it goes. It doesn't really go into any kind of like local history or kind of like historical context or even character context. Because I mean, Eli Roth is just terrible at characters.
Yeah. Although I would say, and I can't believe I'm standing up for Eli Roth here, the fact they're American and they're going to a foreign country and they're kind of trying to impose their will and all this. Anyway, so. I don't know. There is slightly more to it than that. But yeah, I do mostly agree with what you're saying.
I think when it comes to that, for instance, let's not make this a review of Hostel. But,
oh no, believe me. You know, I do that every show anyway. It's fine, dude. Don't worry about it. But yeah,
certainly when it comes to that kind of stuff, that's very, very heavily trodden ground of like kind of like Americans going into another person's country. But again, it doesn't really have any teeth. The characters are just outright kind of assholes from moment one. It's very hard to care about anything or anyone in those. And that has always been the weakness with Eli Roth. I don't think it's even his filmmaking. It's always the writing and characterization.
Exactly.
And I have the same problem with Rob Zombie's films. Rob Zombie,
yeah. I knew exactly what you were going to say as soon as you said his name. Yeah.
You know, Devil's Rejects, a lot of people hold it up as his best film, and arguably it probably is. Although I think Lords of Salem is probably a better film, even if it's less interesting, you know, as a piece of popcorn. It's all about the characters, the situation they're in, and how it informs upon kind of like the situation. And something like Hostel just doesn't have much of that. It's very kind of like an unfleshed out idea.
No, I would say the characters in a Serbian film, although, look, don't get me wrong, the characters in this film are not exactly the deepest characters in history. We're not talking about like a Bergman film here, for example. But at the same time, they are at least consistent in terms of kind of, you know, their purpose in the film. Like the ones who are dodgy are meant to be dodgy. Let's put it that way. The ones you're meant to like are likable. It's fine.
I think Milos and his family probably have the most kind of characterization. I think Vukmir is kind of a boogeyman that sort of respect. We're not supposed to know much about him. He is this sort of faceless kind of character in many respects. Milos does have, you know, a character arc, which is an important thing. You know, it's like I don't think the lead character in Hostel has anything like that, really. It's a very, very, very small, very shallow arc, if that. But Milos does go through this kind of character change.
He has a history as well.
He does have a history. And what you don't know is kind of implied. And he does get enough opportunities to kind of like display the kind of person he is. And, you know, when he's kind of like under the influence and stuff like that, you know, it's not the normal him. Now, there is an argument that it's a kind of latent characteristic of the men in the films, for instance. But we said that there's not a lot of subtlety in the film. I think there is.
Well, it's there wasn't a lot of subtlety.
Buried a little bit. But yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I'm conscious of, you know, wanting to be respectful of your time. So I'll try and round up kind of the show. Mm-hmm. So to wrap up, basically, so my thoughts on the film is that, like I mentioned earlier, the film is very well made. Visually, it looks great. Score, I think the score in and of itself is fine. I just don't think it's used very well in the film. It's quite intrusive in a lot of ways. I would say the characters are generally okay. They're not that deep, but it's fine. They're kind of more kind of used to further the story that the director wants to tell, rather than being sort of independent characters in their own right. And yeah, I mean, I think the film seems to be acted okay. Like, it's got some sort of quite well-known Serbian actors in it, which is quite interesting. And the first kind of hour or so of the film is absolutely fine. There's like barely any kind of questionable content in there whatsoever. It's just by the time you get to the last 30 minutes, the film kind of decides, nah, fuck all this. Like, and then it's just, throws all this kind of absurdly kind of violent content at you. Also, the tone of the film is very weird. The first half of the film has a very kind of almost upbeat tone. It's not like dour or depressing or anything. It's actually quite almost jovial, I find it. It's almost quite, I don't know if that's just me, but it's like, I'm watching this film, it's meant to be, if you had never seen this film before and you're watching this film, it's meant to be one of the most disturbing films of all time. It's almost surprising, like, how kind of, like, upbeat it is in a lot of ways. Like, the pacing is sort of quite frenetic. It doesn't really sort of pause in a lot of ways. And, yeah, the film itself, you know, any kind of places you look at it on the internet in terms of ratings, it's got bad ratings, not because of the quality of the film, but because of the more questionable violent content and sexual content, basically. That's what I think.
I would say that I'll probably make it a much briefer conclusion. I think a Serbian film is a film that deserves calm analysis that belies kind of what it presents. I think there is a surprisingly complete story within it. I think there's some interesting kind of ideas and allegories. And while not everybody's going to have the much time for allegories, and if you don't, then it's probably not the film for you, because what it presents up front is pretty hard going. But if you are given to exploring films and can stomach the kind of extremes that the film goes to, I think there is a film with a lot to reward you with.
Mm. And so you were talking about sort of calm analysis. I've got some calm analysis for you in the form of how bad is it? So this is the part of the show where we're going to talk about a Serbian film for how bad a date movie it is, be it a good date movie. I'm going to assume neither one of us is going to say that. Or it's not that bad. It's bad. It's very bad. Or it's the worst. Now, some of you might be listening to this thinking like this is a bit of a redundant question because we're talking about a Serbian film. In a lot of ways, I would probably agree with you for reasons that we have discussed throughout this review. In terms of how bad a date movie it is, I'm going to say it's the worst. Now, not necessarily for the film itself, because the film itself, some people have said online, Harry Knowles is one of these people who said, well, the film's not actually as violent as people say it is. And in many ways, I kind of agree with that, because first half of the film, not real a lot happens. It's only really like a 25, 30 minute period where all kinds of like shit hits the fan, so to speak. But I think the film has kind of got such a reputation that even the idea of watching a Serbian film in that kind of situation is going to, you're not going to get very far. Let's put it that way. If your intention is to get along famously with the person you're with, suggesting that let's watch a Serbian film, unless you're doing it as a massive, massive, like tongue-in-cheek kind of joke. Because bear in mind, this is a film that there's a wrestling YouTube channel that I don't actually follow anymore, but I used to years ago, where they did a predictions contest, and whoever lost the predictions contest had to watch a Serbian film as a punishment. So basically, it's now used in that way. It's now got that kind of reputation that, yeah, it's used as a way to kind of inadvertently torture people, although for fun, for the lols, as opposed to in a like Guantanamo Bay kind of scenario. So I'm going to say it's the worst. Glenn, what do you say?
I'd say unless you're with a girl that you really kind of know can handle that kind of stuff, it would be a pretty much the one of the worst at the very least. I wouldn't show a date this any more than I would Cannibal Holocaust or Salo or I Spit on Your Grave as a opening gambit, put it that way. And chances are you ain't going to find too many people who are going to be kind of patient enough with this movie or willing to sit through the excesses of it. So, it's definitely up there in the very bad.
Yeah, it's up there for me. Yeah, Cannibal Holocaust, I Spit on Your Grave. Salo, I can't remember if I put in the worst. I probably should have done. Maybe I kind of gave it kudos for like artistic merit or whatever. The August Underground trilogy, I also gave that the worst as well. I mean, why you would want to watch those on a date, fuck knows. And the Vomit Gore trilogy as well, kind of goes without saying. Like, but yes, it would go up with those. Although I would say that this film is better than all the August Underground films and all three of the Vomit Gore films as well. That's just my opinion.
I would tend to agree from what I've seen of the August Underground. Yes. I wouldn't even give that for, to sort of semi-quote a Serbian film for the self-loving kind of date.
There we go. Can't really put it any better than that. So that note that I'm going to thank very, very much Glenn Criddle. So Glenn, where is it that people can find you?
Now, you can find me on YouTube as LampyMan101 or just Google The Nasties Review and I'll pop up.
Yeah, definitely a worthwhile endeavour. If you want to watch video Nasties reviews that weren't done by me on the Lament configuration with Riff End, then yeah, Glenn is the one to go to. So Glenn, thank you so much for doing the show. Really, really thank appreciate you. It. As indeed, I appreciate all of you for listening to the show. So this is actually the last episode in the current series of Worst Date Movies Ever. Where has the time gone? Jesus Christ, it's lockdown and all this kind of stuff. It's made time appear to go very, very short. But anyway, That's enough rambling from me. So the next series of worst date movies ever will not be too far in the future. I'm aiming to do the next series at the end of the year. I'm sure Glenn can kind of back me up on this. It's a lot easier recording when it's cold as to when it's the middle of summer and it's fucking hot, particularly, you know, when you've got closed doors, you've got to have lights on, all this kind of stuff. It's just, yeah, no fun. So yeah, so I'll be back towards the end of the year. And on that note, I wish you a very good day wherever you are right now. And yeah, we'll see you for the next series of the worst date movies ever. Thank you for listening. If you want to follow me on social media, you can at Worst Date Movies Ever. And don't forget to click subscribe wherever you're listening to this right now to never miss another episode of Worst Date Movies Ever.